Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, we're going to chat about the history of the United States of America. We're actually going to do something a little bit different this week, and for that matter, for this next month or so, in fact, because for a long time, I've wanted to get into some bigger topics, some historical content that just absolutely could not be crammed into a single episode, or even into two episodes, because we've done two-parters before, right? We've even done a three-parter, episodes 247 to 249, History of Flight, Get Across It. But for the first time in half-assed history, we are going to do a four-part mini-series on the history of the United States. This is obviously a massive topic, and even in four episodes, I don't think we're going to be able to go into any great level of detail. But I want to talk about the history of the US, given how important this nation is in today's world, in the 21st century, as a global hegemonic superpower, as a nation that has so much influence across most of the world, and a nation that right now may be entering into a period of decline as well. This is something we'll explore towards the end of this little mini-series here, because where we're starting, of course, is right at the beginning. In this episode, we will talk about the indigenous population of the land that would go on to become the United States. We'll talk about its colonization of this land. We'll talk about the path that these colonists took towards revolution and then independence. And then, of course, what happened after the nation was founded. We'll come back next week to talk about the United States in the 19th century, the impact of its westward expansion, the institution of slavery, and how this brought on the Civil War, and then the period after the Civil War, known as Reconstruction. Part three, we'll deal with the United States heading into the 20th century, the Gilded Age, the Progressive Era, and then, of course, the World Wars, as well as the Great Depression and the New Deal. And then finally, we'll talk about the United States' post-war path to global hegemony, including the Cold War, the Civil Rights Movement, Reaganomics, and the United States in the 21st century after September 11. I know this is a pretty huge departure from the usual format of the show, you know, the usual one-and-done self-contained episodes that we so often do, but I'm keen to give this a go, see what people think, and if you like it, terrific. Maybe I'll do others in time. I've got a list. I've always wanted to get episodes out on the French Revolution, for instance, but I've always been just too completely overwhelmed by the size of the topic. On the other hand, if you hate it, sorry, I guess. Sorry about that. We'll be back to regular episodes in a month or so don't worry too much. And I should say as well, given the nature of these episodes, given that we're taking a pretty broad bird's eye view of the entire history of a nation, we're not going to go into too much detail. We're not going to go into a huge amount of detail. This is very much an overview, but hopefully it will still be of some interest to you. Hopefully we'll learn a thing or two as we go, and hopefully we'll understand a bit more about the United States by the end of it all. Because no matter what you think of the United States, it is a very important nation. Metternich once said, "When France sneezes, the rest of Europe catches a cold." But today, it's when America sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. And whether you like it or not, the United States, as the world's sole superpower, is, as I say, A very, very important nation with a history that hopefully will be of some interest to you. Anyway, let's get underway here. Let's get stuck into this little four-part mini-series on the history of the United States. We've got so much to get across, so let's not waste time and get into it here. Off we go. We're going all the way back here. We're going all the way back to around 10,000 BCE. That's 12,000 years ago. The point at which we can definitively say that the area that would go on to become today's United States of America was first settled. Now, it could have happened a lot earlier than this. Humans may have made their way across to the North American continent as early as 30,000 years ago. We're still not exactly sure of the timeline, but in any case, a great many millennia ago, humans travelled across a land bridge that connected Siberia and North America. They did this probably during an ice age in search of better sources of food. And then once they arrived in North America, they slowly spread across the continent in the coming thousands of years. These first Native Americans moved further south, some of them staying where they were, some of them continuing on, but all eventually settling down and establishing a great number of very diverse communities and cultures across North America and beyond. They farmed, they built, they hunted, they actually hunted all too effectively, in fact, hunting the mammoths that lived in North America to extinction. And again, depending on their region, they developed their own distinct cultures, customs, traditions, and ways of life. We're distilling thousands upon thousands of years of history here, so I am speaking in very broad terms, but across what is today the United States, in time, countless cultural and linguistic groups would develop and establish themselves. There was the Clovis culture and the Folsom tradition, nomadic hunter-gatherers that roamed the continent hunting mammoth and bison. The Nardene people established themselves in what we today call the Pacific Northwest. They built seasonal settlements on the coast to hunt and fish. Later on in history, cultures centered on mound building emerged. The mound builders would, can you guess, build great big mounds, huge earthwork constructions, which they lived on and amongst. And many of these mounds still exist today, even if the settlements attached to them haven't stood the test of time. Most famously, of course, the Cahokia Mounds in the modern-day state of Illinois. Closer to the beginning of the Common Era, a vast network of communities would trade with one another. Today, we identify these cultures as being part of the Hopewell tradition. And the peoples and the cultures of the Hopewell tradition, they were all spread across today's Midwestern United States, a vast area, and used rivers and waterways to transport trade goods between one another. They had permanent settlements. They shared not just trade links, but also communication and cultural links too. Although they were all very distinct cultural and linguistic groups of people. And in addition to trading communities like these, agricultural communities sprang up along the Mississippi River, with powerful regional settlements exercising a lot of influence and control over their surroundings. The Mississippian culture saw the creation of large settlements, prosperous farms, and great works of art too. Finely worked stone, pottery, jewelry, and all sorts of other stuff like that. And then over in the southwest of what we today call the United States, there were cultures like the ancestral Puebloan culture or the Hohokam culture, who adapted to life in arid surroundings, developing farming techniques that didn't rely on abundant water and constructing incredible settlements as they did so, with buildings made of stone and earth. Perhaps most famously, Cliff Palace, a settlement built by the ancestral Puebloan people. An incredible feat of engineering and construction. And it's still around today. Incredible to look at. Anyway, perhaps most famously of all, when it comes to the indigenous populations of North America, was a civilization that rose to prominence in the mid-15th century, shortly before the European colonization of the Americas began, the Iroquois Confederacy, or the Haudenosaunee. In the northeast of today's United States, various cultural groups came together to form a confederacy, a decentralized political power structure, and grew to become immensely powerful as they did so. They expanded their territory enormously, with the confederacy stretching at its peak from upstate New York all the way across to Illinois, from northern Michigan down past the Kentucky-Tennessee border. This was a large and a prosperous, and as I say, a very powerful civilization, with not just an extensive and well-developed trade network within and further beyond its territory, but also a sizable military that made it, as I say, one of the most powerful and certainly one of the most important pre-Columbian civilizations in North America. So the area that we today refer to as the United States of America has, as you can tell, a very, very long history, having been explored and settled and lived in for thousands and thousands of years before Europeans arrive. In fact, it's easy for us these days to consider these lands to be, you know, sort of immutably part of the US. But when you think about it, these lands have spent a lot longer not being part of the United States of America than they have actually being part of the United States of America. Sadly, however, we don't have a lot of access to the history of many of the indigenous peoples of the land that would go on to become the US. Much of their history is inaccessible to us these days, as most Native American cultures didn't have writing systems to make detailed records of their histories. Some did. Some cultures had proto-writing systems, such as the Ojibwe and their birchbark scrolls. Some, like the Haudenosaunee, they used knotted belts to keep records. But broadly speaking, most Native American history was never written down in the same way that history was written down in other parts of the world. But look, that's not a knock on Native American cultures, as we talked about in episode 300, The History of History, Get Across It. Writing is a very difficult thing to invent, despite being one of the most important things we ever came up with as a species. It was only thought of three times, once in Mesopotamia, once in China, and then once in Mesoamerica. But the result of this is that the explicit histories of much of pre-Columbian North America is not something that we have a lot of access to today. Instead, our knowledge of these peoples and cultures is based on research, on archaeology, and of course, on oral history that has been passed down through the generations. Anyway, as we move now into the next chapter of this region's history, it's worth remembering two things. Firstly, that Native Americans were not, and are not, one great big monolithic people, all with the same culture and language and values and way of life. Just as Europe has all sorts of different peoples and cultures with their own customs and traditions and languages and whatever else, just as even the US today has vast regional diversity. Compare the average metropolitan Californian with the average rural Oklahoman. Native American peoples were and still are very diverse, very distinct. Secondly, as we begin now to talk about colonization, terms like discovery and discovered and the like, these aren't particularly suitable to use when talking about the arrival of Europeans in the Americas, because Europeans didn't discover America. To discover something, you have to be the first one to find it, and Europeans discovered a continent, a land, that people had lived on for a very long time. They'd known about it for thousands of years. It would be a bit like saying Americans discovered the moon because they were the first to get there on a rocket ship. Now, look, well done. Great job on getting there. USA number one indeed. But, you know, we all knew the moon existed before Neil Armstrong rocked up. He didn't discover the thing with his giant leap for mankind. And for more on that particular giant leap, have a listen to episode 150, The Apollo Program, Get Across It. Anyway, While Native Americans had the run of the place for millennia, eventually Europeans turned up on the shores of North America. But Columbus wasn't the first. No, no. Many people suffer from the misapprehension that Christopher Columbus was the first person from Europe to arrive in the Americas, and this is not so. This bloke gets a lot of undeserved credit, as we'll touch upon further in a little bit. No, the first Europeans to arrive in North America were Nordic explorers. They were Vikings who landed, it's thought, in what is today Canada, around the beginning of the 11th century. Lance Olmedo's in the Canadian province of Newfoundland and Labrador is widely held to be the first ever European settlement in North America, being established and then abandoned within a pretty brief period overall, but a lot earlier than any other Europeans turned up. It's commonly said that the Viking explorer Leif Erikson was behind the establishment of this settlement. That's not quite definitively established historical fact, but it's also by no means historical fiction either. He certainly could have been involved. We just don't know. We don't know exactly when the Vikings arrived. We don't know exactly when they left. And we don't know how much else of the North American coastline that they explored. But they were definitely there almost 500 years before Columbus, who, again, gets all the credit for having discovered America, which is nonsense for a couple of reasons. Firstly, as I said, you can't discover something which people already know about. And secondly, because Columbus never even set foot in North America. After setting sail, as most people will know, in 1492 from Spain, this Italian, he explored the Caribbean. He made it to Central and even to South America across his four voyages over the Atlantic, but he never once visited or even saw the land that would go on to become the US. Columbus is revered by many Americans these days as a heroic figure, a brave, intrepid explorer who set out to prove his critics wrong, to discover America and bring home a cheeseburger to prove it. He has been so thoroughly mythologized, this bloke, that not many people know him for what he actually was, a cruel, avaricious, tyrannical, and honestly, quite foolish bloke. He set off in search, as many listeners may be aware, to find a westward passage to India, and until the day he died, he maintained that he had done so, and this is why Native Americans are still often referred to as Indians. Of course, he never made it as far as Asia. He never found this westward passage that he considered that he had. But all the same, he was lionized by the United States into the 19th century when this newly founded nation was looking for non-English heroes with which to build its own national mythology, separate from the British that they'd just defeated. And so he became a legendary figure to people in the United States, despite, once again, never actually landing in what would go on to become the United States. Anyway, despite Columbus's great many shortcomings, there is no doubt that this bloke completely changed the course of human history with his voyages. Because in the wake of Columbus making it across the Atlantic to the Americas, more and more European explorers and colonists were sent over to what was termed, back then, the New World. The Spanish and the Portuguese established themselves in South America, with the Spanish also taking colonial possession of much of the Caribbean, Central America, and even sending expeditions into what would become the United States as well. They claimed Florida for Spain. The French also colonized parts of the Caribbean, in addition to parts of what is today Canada, most notably, of course, Quebec, but also took colonial possession of a section of today's US, west of Florida along the Gulf, the modern-day state of Louisiana, and the lands to its north. The Swedish went over there too, as did the Dutch. Manhattan Island was originally a Dutch colonial possession, and New York City was first named New Amsterdam. But the focus of our history of colonial America will, of course, be on the people who took Manhattan and New Amsterdam off the Dutch, the people who sailed to and established colonies along the east coast of North America, the people responsible, ultimately, for the creation of the United States of America, the English. The English, until 1707, after which they became the British, first sent colonists to North America in 1585 and established the ill-fated Roanoke colony in today's Virginia, which failed. It's not known exactly what happened to the 100 or so colonists that were left behind to maintain the colony, but when the British came back 5 years later, it had been abandoned, and the ultimate fate of its people is still a mystery to us today. The English tried again, however, in 1607 with the establishment of the colonial settlement of Jamestown, again in Virginia, and this one managed to scrape through. Early English colonists, like the one sent to Jamestown, were actually under the private authority of commercial companies, not the English crown, and it was very bloody hard yakka for them. They weren't prepared for the hardships that colonial life would bring them, disease, starvation, freezing cold weather. Although, of course, the suffering that these colonists went through was nothing compared to what happened to the Native American populations that they encountered, and even those that they didn't encounter. Because these European colonists brought with them not just a total lack of recognition of the existing ownership of North American lands, but also a range of horrific and deadly diseases. Native Americans had no natural or genetic resistance to these old world diseases, and as the diseases spread throughout their communities, untold thousands of them perished. Epidemics swept through Native Americans in the wake of the European arrivals, and a huge proportion of their populations died without ever having seen the Europeans that brought their end. These diseases ravaged indigenous populations up and down the coast, spreading further inland and killing more people than we will ever know or understand. But this, of course, was just the beginning for the poor old Native Americans. Their world would never be the same again, as we'll talk about next week. Anyway, the English colonial effort was bolstered in the 1610s when experimentation with the planting of tobacco crops were immensely successful in places like Virginia, bringing an all-new source of wealth to the colonies. And this, in turn, only hastened the spread of more colonists up and down the East Coast, which were very quickly brought under royal and governmental authority rather than remaining under the private authority of those companies that I mentioned. 13 colonies in all were established, and we can broadly divide them into three separate categories: the southern colonies, the middle colonies, and up in the north, New England. The southern colonies included Virginia, Maryland, Carolina, later split into North and South Carolina, and finally Georgia. And these colonies were agricultural, their economies entirely reliant on plantations and the sales of their crops, plantations that were extremely profitable, of course, due to their reliance on unfree labor, which we'll come back to. The middle colonies included New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. And these colonies were notable for a few different things. They had plenty of agricultural land that was settled and planted, just as in the South. But there were also great forests and abundant mines that were exploited for raw materials, which led to the rise of industry in the middle colonies, particularly the shipbuilding industry. The middle colonies also both traded and fought with the Iroquois, which generated further wealth through the fur trade. But one of the more interesting things that made the that separated the middle colonies from the colonies to the north and to the south was the fact that they were known for their tolerance and acceptance of people from what was at the time a broad and diverse set of backgrounds. Because colonists were still almost all white and all Christian, but the middle colonies were a lot more accepting of people like the Irish, the Dutch, the Germans. They were accepting of people from all these weird, different Protestant sects. And this is in stark contrast with much of New England. The colonies in New England, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont became the 14th state in 1791, while Maine was actually still part of Massachusetts at this stage, so they're not quite on the map yet. But New England was one of the first areas to see large colonial settlements spring up and was overwhelmingly settled by Protestant Puritans fleeing what they considered to be religious persecution. Now, it's obviously a lot more complex than this. This is a very simplistic view of things, but the Puritans, broadly speaking, they still thought Anglicanism back in the old country was far too Catholic for their tastes. They didn't like things such as, you know, singing and dancing and generally having a good time. So the Puritans, they packed their bags and moved away. They left England behind and instead moved to New England to establish their colonies, where they were free from the religious persecution of singing and dancing and having a good time, free to set up their own communities with strictly enforced moral and religious codes, after which they did things like, this is not a joke, ban Christmas. In 1659, Christmas was banned in Boston by the Puritans. So when you next hear about the war on Christmas, just remember, this is a tried and true red, white, and blue American tradition that dates all the way back to colonial times. The Puritans in New England, they were banning Christmas before these godless heathens were coming along with their happy holidays and their joyful festive seasons. But the Puritans had a hard time of it as well, to begin with. The first Puritan colonists, the so-called Pilgrims, they almost died off completely after sailing over to the New World on the Mayflower in 1620. But luckily for them, the Wampanoag Native Americans helped them out by giving them food and teaching them how to farm corn, and so the colonists survived. And this is one of the origins of the American celebration of Thanksgiving, although Thanksgiving celebrations have got much older roots going all the way back to the Old World and the Protestant Reformation. We don't need to get into that. Anyway, the New England colonies, they were known not only for their strict enforcement of puritanical religion and morals, but also for their industry. And I mean this term in both senses. Puritans were hardworking, they were industrious people. But the land that they settled in was unsuitable for widespread agriculture, and so instead, industry emerged as the region's primary industry, I guess. Sawmills, factories, docks, trading centres, other commercial enterprises, these are what dominated the colonial societies of New England, making it a very wealthy part of the world. In fact, it wasn't just the New England colonies that enjoyed great wealth. All 13 colonies ended up becoming extremely prosperous, so prosperous, in fact, that they outstripped much of England in terms of wealth and quality of life. And this, as you can imagine, made people in their thousands want to move to the colonies and seek fortunes of their own, which brings us back to something I mentioned earlier, a hallmark of the southern colonies in particular, unfree labour. Unfree labour was what underpinned the prosperity of the 13 colonies and then later the United States that came after them. And I'm not just talking about slavery here, because to begin with the initial colonization of the Americas, the institution that played a much larger role in when it came to unfree labour was indentured servitude. For people who wanted to move to the colonies but didn't have any way to pay for their transport there, indentured servitude was their only option. The majority of immigrants to the colonies came as indentured servants, people who had agreed to work for no pay for a set period, usually 4 to 7 years, working to pay off the price of being transported over there. 500,000 immigrants arrived as indentured servants, which, as you can imagine, was a huge economic boon for all the people that they worked for. Forced labor is extremely profitable, after all. But more profitable yet than indentured servants with their set period of unfree labor were slaves, as more and more slaves were brought to the colonies to labor and toil for their entire lives, not just for a set period of years. The practice of indentured servitude slowly but steadily declined. And instead, poor Africans were loaded up onto ships on the other side of the Atlantic, taken across the ocean to the American slave markets, and sold into a lifetime of bondage. And it was overwhelmingly the southern states where slaves were brought and sold, as they provided the labor on the vast plantations that formed the backbone of the southern colonies' economies. Such was the hunger for labor and for workers in colonial America that slavery was entrenched across much of it as an essential institution, something without which the colonial economies would undoubtedly just collapse. And the stain that this institution has left on the United States can still be felt today. The long-lasting impact of slavery on this nation can be very clearly seen in the 21st century. We'll talk a lot more, of course, about slavery as an institution, its eventual undoing, and its legacy in American history and in the American present in the 21st century. But for now, it's time to move on to the next chapter of American history, revolution and independence.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The 13 colonies had a very good thing going into the 18th century. They were rich. There was an abundance of land and resources for them to exploit. Laborers and workers were arriving by the shipload, and you didn't even have to bloody pay them. And whenever the colonies came under threat, Britain, it's after 1707 now, so it's Britain and not England, Britain would come to their defense. Britain had a vested interest in keeping the colonies successful and prosperous, as much of the colonial wealth flowed back across the Atlantic and into the coffers in London. So, whenever the neighbouring French or Spanish looked like they might be trying to expand their colonial influence in North America, the British were very quick to rush to the defence of their colonies and keep their imperial rivals at bay. However, Things changed in the 1760s with the resounding British victory in the Seven Years' War, known in the colonies as the French and Indian War. This war saw a drastic reduction in the power and the influence of the French and Spanish in North America. The French were forced to hand over huge sections of territory to the British, everything east of the Mississippi and what would go on to become Canada, and the Spanish, meanwhile, had to hand over Florida. The British were therefore largely unchallenged in the on the eastern side of North America, and this, interestingly enough, gave rise to a new and somewhat unexpected challenger. The French and Indian War had seen the 13 colonies and their people band together like never before to defend themselves, aiding the British troops sent in across the Atlantic to fight and to win the war. You may have seen the famous Join or Die cartoon. It was done by Benjamin Franklin, episode 255, Get Across It. It represents a snake that's been chopped up into little pieces. This was initially used not to convince people to fight the Revolutionary War against the British, but actually it was used to convince people to join together and fight the French and Indian War. Because, as I said, the colonies relied on the British for their survival in the face of external imperial threats. However, now, after the French and Indian War, there were no external imperial threats. And so throughout the colonies, a new mode of thinking began to emerge. Why do we even need the British in the first place? People started to say. What do we actually gain from being subservient colonies? Over in London, of course, they were very keen to hold on to these colonies. They wanted to use the wealth that they generated to do things like pay for the wars that they were fighting, wars such as the French and Indian War, wars that had protected the interests of the colonies. And now more than ever, the British needed wealth after the vast expense of the Seven Years' War, and so they turned to their prosperous colonies to help to pay for the very war that had protected them. The colonists, however, they weren't so keen on doing so, especially now that there wasn't any threat to them. And this is where tensions began. The British saw the colonies as owing them a debt, essentially. They should help to fund this war that they'd just fight because the war was fought for the benefit of and in the interests of the colonies. But the colonists, on the other hand, they felt that the taxes the British began to levy on them in the wake of the French and Indian War were immensely unfair and unjust. The British passed the Stamp Act in 1765, which imposed a direct tax on the colonies, and as you can imagine, they didn't like that very much. And then the Stamp Act was followed by the Townshend Acts, which brought with them more taxes. Tensions grew between the British and their colonists into the 1770s. In 1770, a group of British soldiers fired upon and killed five protesters in an angry mob of hundreds in an event known as the Boston Massacre. And this did little to de-escalate tensions, as did a new tax that was put in place on tea, which saw, of course, the Boston Tea Party take place. This was a famous protest involving unhappy colonists dressing up as Native Americans and dumping crates and crates of tea into Boston's harbour from an East India Company ship. No taxation without representation, the colonists insisted. They didn't have a voice in the British Parliament, and therefore the British Parliament had no right to levy taxes on them. Now, this is an admirable sentiment, and it was one that was taken up as a rallying cry by those across the colonies who stood against the British and their taxes. Most notably, perhaps, a group called the Sons of Liberty, who agitated against the British for the rights of colonists. And in 1774, as tensions continued to grow between Britain and the colonists held the First Continental Congress, which not only called on colonists up and down the East Coast to boycott British trade, cancel culture gone mad, but also sent a list of grievances to the British King, George III. And to cut a long story short, old mate George completely ignored these grievances and the British continued to tax the colonies as they saw fit, enforcing these taxes with the threat of force from the British Army. And it quickly became more than a threat, too, because the British began to transport soldiers and weapons to the colonies, and the colonists, well, they began to organise themselves into militias to resist the British should it come to violence, as it seemed it was going to. These anti-British forces became known as Patriots, a group of people brought together to fight for the ideals of the Age of Enlightenment, liberty, natural rights, and the rejection of traditional hierarchy. They were, in effect, liberals. I wonder how the people who today call themselves patriots would feel about that realization. Anyway, the Patriots, they began to stockpile weapons, which the British didn't like. And when the British attempted to seize these stockpiles of weapons just outside Boston, in the town of Concord, on the 19th of April, 1775, the American Revolutionary War began. After a brief skirmish in the nearby town of Lexington, the British marched to Concord and the Americans there defended a bridge from the British advance. And these conflicts became known as the Battles of Lexington and Concord. The opening actions of the American Revolutionary War, often said to have begun with the shot heard round the world, the first shot fired in Lexington. But honestly, I don't know about that. I don't want to have a go at any Americans listening, but the US does love to play itself and its history up just a little bit. A bit of a case of main character syndrome sometimes. And I very much doubt that many people outside this region cared or even knew about this minor scuffle in some British colonial backwater. The shot heard round the neighbourhood, certainly. I mean, guns are pretty loud at the end of the day. Even the shot heard round the colonies eventually as war broke out. But around the world? I wouldn't say so. The United States, even after its independence, remained of only very little international importance until the 20th century, really, which, of course, we will get into in full in the coming episode. So I really don't think many people were paying attention to the battles of Lexington and Concord and the outbreak of the American Revolutionary War around the world. This was, as I say, at the time, a minor colonial scuffle that barely involved a couple of hundred people. So I know the United States does have a bit of a love affair with its own history, but the shot heard around the world might not quite capture the real importance of these battles at the time. Anyway, war had begun. Open conflict was now being fought between the British and the Americans, and as a result, the Second Continental Congress was held in Independence Hall in Philadelphia, and the fact that they ended up calling this venue Independence Hall will probably give you a bit of a clue as to what exactly happened there. The Second Continental Congress firstly authorized the creation of the Continental Army and appointed a moderately capable commander to lead it, a bloke who had fought for the British in the French and Indian War and had a war record that was fine, really. He'd won a few, he'd lost a few, he'd been passed over for some promotions, he'd had to surrender a fort at some point, but generally he'd done okay. And his name was, as you may already know, George Washington. And he went on to not just serve as the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, but later, as we'll discuss, he served as the first president of the United States after the... Oh, sorry. I'm spoiling it all for you. The Americans did win the war. Sorry about that. Yeah, spoilers. Anyway, that wasn't all the Second Continental Congress did as the war continued, as Washington and the Continental Army pushed the British out of Boston into 1776. The Congress continued to gather in Philadelphia, and in a move that would shape the course of the history of that region, and in later centuries shape the course of the history of the world, the Second Continental Congress voted to declare independence from the British Crown. And this, as every red-blooded American knows, the vote to declare independence was held in Philadelphia on July the 2nd? Yeah, no, it wasn't the 4th. It was actually the 2nd that they voted to declare independence. But then, of course, after having been written by the Committee of Five, or mainly just Thomas Jefferson, the United States Declaration of Independence, one of the most important political documents in American history, was signed by the delegates to the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia on the 2nd of August? Huh? Okay, all right. Well, I guess, yeah, as we talked about in episode 267, History's Biggest Misconceptions Get Across It, the 4th of July was not when the Congress voted in favor of independence, and was also not when the declaration itself was signed by the delegates, But instead, it was when the delegates ratified the declaration and when just one man, the president of the Second Continental Congress, a bloke by the name of John Hancock, when he signed the declaration, his ludicrously large signature can still be seen on the declaration if you go and visit it and see it for yourself in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. And the date that it was ratified was chosen as, ultimately, America's national holiday. And to this very day, the 4th of July is when Americans enjoy gathering together, having a barbecue and, you know, blowing off their spare fingers with fireworks on, as I say, 4th of July, not the 2nd of July, not the 2nd of August. But more seriously, the Declaration of Independence was, and still is, a monumentally important political document. It founded much of the political philosophy of the United States, and this political philosophy has, for better or worse, gone on to influence much of the world, particularly in more recent centuries. Anyway, let's whiz through the Revolutionary War itself here. We're not going to get into a blow-by-blow account of the conflict because we would be here all week, but here's the short version. As I mentioned, amongst the first things that Washington and the Continental Army did was push the British out of Boston, with the siege of Boston ending in the Americans' favour in March 1776. After the Declaration of Independence in July and August, I guess, the British invaded and captured New York, which became and ultimately remained throughout the war a British stronghold. Washington wasn't able to retake New York, but he did manage to get out of there without taking too many losses afterwards, to his credit. And then, in December 1776, Washington made his famous decision to cross the Delaware River, immortalized in a famous painting, and after this, managed to win a series of important victories against the British in New Jersey. In 1777, we saw the beginning of the Saratoga campaign. One of the most well-known commanders in that campaign was the infamous Benedict Arnold, the Turncoat, episode 228, get across it. And the Saratoga campaign was successful enough to get the French to take the Americans and their Revolutionary War seriously. Americans today love to get after the French and mock their supposed weakness on the battlefield, but let me tell you something. Without the French, the Americans may never have beaten the British in the first place. After wintering in Valley Forge in 1778, the Americans signed a treaty of alliance with the French. The French doubtlessly thinking the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and this new alliance greatly aided the ongoing American war effort. Between 1778 and 1781, the British focused their efforts on attacking the southern colonies, managing to capture cities like Charleston and Savannah. But the Continental Army fought back and the American Revolutionary War came to a de facto end in October 1781 with Washington's victory over the British Lord Cornwallis at the Siege of Yorktown. While King George didn't order a British withdrawal until 1782 and the war didn't technically end until the Treaty of Paris in 1783, the Americans won their war of independence with the Siege of Yorktown, securing their freedom from British rule and their future as an independent, sovereign nation. Washington resigned his commission as commander-in-chief at the end of 1783, and Americans looked to the future. Now that they had their independence, what would they do with it? Well, what they did with it was kind of stuff it all up beyond belief, to be honest, because we definitely didn't go from the American Revolutionary War straight into the United States of America as we know and love them today, I can tell you that. No. The US Constitution, the one that is still in place today, it wasn't established until 1789. So, what happened in the meantime? Well, for the most part, a great big mess, that's what, as the Continental Congress passed the Articles of Confederation as the foundation of a new, independent American government. The Articles of Confederation greatly limited the exercising of centralized political power and instead gave over most political power to the newly formed states, the direct successors to the 13 colonies. But with a weak central government, this new nation was unable to do things like raise money to pay its debts. They couldn't pass effective laws. They couldn't govern the territory it was in possession of, that is, the land under its control that wasn't part of an existing state. And so rapid economic decline immediately followed the Revolutionary War. Conflict with Native Americans intensified as settlers moved west into the territories, And overall, this new country didn't seem like it was going to have what it would take to stick around. It was weak, it was fragile, it was fractious and divided, and many, particularly those who had fought in the war itself, they were worried that it would topple at the first sign of trouble. Internal rebellion, external invasion, economic collapse. The United States was at risk of being over before it began if one of these things ended up consuming it. It did not get off to a strong start in the 1780s. And so in 1787, the Continental Congress called the Philadelphia Convention with a view to replace the Articles of Confederation with a new constitution, one with a strong central government that had the ability to govern effectively, to raise taxes, to oversee affairs that affected the states as a whole. Delegates were sent from each and every one of the 13 states, and together they wrote and put in place the Constitution of the United States. And this remarkable document established guaranteed rights and liberties to United States citizens, especially when it was first amended to include the famous Bill of Rights, and it established a republican government, republican in the sense that it's a republic, not in the sense of the modern political party. And this republican government involved the division of power between three branches of government, the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive. And each branch had its own checks and balances on the power that it could exercise. Now, the US Constitution is far from a perfect document. In fact, it's in desperate need of some updates to bring it in line with what makes modern representative democracies actually function. But for what it was at the time, the US Constitution was a game changer. Remember, democratic governments, even deeply flawed ones like the one created by the US Constitution with its Electoral College and other nonsense, democratic governments were vanishingly rare in the late 18th century. Switzerland had some democratic elements in its governance. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and the Dutch Republic, they did elect some of their governmental officials. But modern democracy was very much in its infancy, and the US was helping the cause in its own way with this somewhat radical approach to the formation of government. Soon, the French Republic would follow in the wake of the revolution there. Democracies would spread further and further around the world through revolution or reform. And so it's fair to say that in modern terms, the US was definitely doing this before it was cool. Although now their democratic systems are a little behind the times, I suppose you could say, and it might be time for a fresh lick of paint on the flawed democracy that is the United States. And that's not me calling it that either. That's not me using that term. The United States was ranked 29th in the world in the 2023 Democracy Index by The Economist. It was labeled by The Economist as a flawed democracy. That's the term they used. Anyway, the United States Constitution, as a foundational document in US history, it had both positives and negatives. It was established as, despite what some people will tell you, a flexible document, one that has been amended no fewer than 27 times. And a level of flexibility is obviously a very good thing to address and adapt to the changing political landscapes that progress will bring. Its system of separation of powers and checks and balances also has been very influential in other constitutional setups. And its guaranteeing of freedoms and rights to its citizens is, for the most part, very, very admirable. Not so much when it comes to the Second Amendment, unfortunately, but I don't think the people that wrote that amendment could have possibly foreseen things like school children getting their hands on AR-15, so it's not entirely on them. But another positive that came from the United States Constitution was that it established quite an innovative model of federalist government, a model that has been very successful in many other democracies around the world, including Australia, of course, which is a federation that takes a lot of constitutional cues from the United States, separating and dividing up certain powers between a centralized federal government and the divided state governments underneath it. However, the US Constitution also has some pretty bloody awful things in it, and some of these have not stuck around, thankfully. Others are still part of this document, sadly. And in doing so, in putting these rather unfortunate inclusions into the text of the Constitution, It set some pretty unfortunate precedents. Some pretty terrible political precedents were set by the United States Constitution. For instance, the fact that the original Constitution not only allowed but condoned the institution of slavery, including what's known as the Three-Fifths Compromise, that a slave, for the purposes of political representation, was 60% of a person. Or the Electoral College, one of the most undemocratic institutions passed off as being in support of democracy. It turns US elections into ridiculous games that need to be won by the absurd contortion of numbers. And also, a weakness that sometimes gets overlooked when it comes to the US Constitution is the fact that it isn't written in what I'd call particularly exacting language. It's also pretty short. This lack of detail has caused more than a few issues over the years. The ambiguity and the vagueness in this document has been exploited by people for their own political ends ever since it was written. But for better or worse, the US Constitution was ratified by the 13 states in 1788, and so elections were held for the first president of the United States under this new constitution. And with 99.9% of the popular vote, with 11.6% voter turnout, sounds really democratic so far, doesn't it? The first president of the United States of America under the new constitution was, of course, coming out of retirement, George Washington himself. The United States of America were off and away. And as they moved into the 19th century, a new set of challenges emerged. Establishing themselves as an independent nation on the global stage, expanding westward across the continent, the displacement and the killing of Native Americans, grappling with the role of slavery within the Union, dealing with a destructive civil war and its fallout. Next week, we will talk about all of this and so much more as we continue this overview of the history of the United States of America. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. One down and three to go in our four-part mini-series on the history of the United States. And I hope you're enjoying it so far. Do let me know what you think. I'm very keen for feedback. I was a little nervous deciding to pull the trigger on this four-part series because I know, based on some previous feedback, that there are some listeners who aren't super keen on the longer topics that span multiple episodes. But I want to see how it goes. I want to see what the response is. And I want to get a sense of what the interest would be like for more mini-series like these in the future. I don't think I'd be doing them all the time. I think it'd only be, you know, a couple of times a year. But all the same, I do want to know what people think. And I also want to welcome in any new listeners who are joining the podcast for the first time, particularly anyone joining us from the land of the free and the home of the brave. It is excellent to have you along, and I want to point out that there is a lot of other American history for you to get across in the back catalogue of this podcast. You can go back and hear about the Watergate scandal, for instance, episode 160. I already mentioned the Apollo program, episode 150. What else have we got? You can go and hear about Amelia Earhart, the famous aviator, episode 218. You can hear about some of the more ridiculous aspects of American history. For instance, the story of the 1904 Olympic marathon held in the American city of St. Louis, episode 48, get across it. That one truly is absurd. Episode 189, the capture of Guam, when the United States Navy kind of almost accidentally seized the island of Guam. And there's also plenty of biographical episodes about some of the most famous and important figures from the history of the United States. I said episode 255, Benjamin Franklin, but also people like Frederick Douglass, episodes 234, 235, get across that. Robert Smalls as well, another very famous figure in American history, an escaped slave who ended up becoming a U.S. congressman, if you'll believe it. Episode 56, get across that. So plenty of American history for you to get your teeth stuck into if you've got a taste for it. And of course, we'll be back with more American history as we continue an overview of the history of this nation in the coming weeks. Anyway, all the boring housekeeping stuff as usual here, halfhousehistory.net. That's the best place to go to find the contact form if you want to get in touch, and also the merch store. Be sure to head to the new merch store if you're based in Australia or Aotearoa New Zealand. Rest of the world will probably find their best option is the TeePublic store, which, as I've mentioned I guess a few times now, is closing soon, probably pretty soon, I would say, in the next couple of weeks. So grab anything off that if you're wanting to. And if you want to support the show on Patreon, you certainly can, and any and all support is greatly appreciated. It's one of the biggest reasons this show is out on time every week. And we've had a couple of new people sign up on Patreon this week, patreon.com/halfhousehistory. Emily Lyon, Strix, and John Harris have all signed up, so thank you very much to the three of you. If you want to join in their exalted footsteps, head over patreon.com/halfhousehistory, gain access to uncut episodes, show notes, and of course, ad-free listening, as well as exclusive Patreon-only merch. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell people about whom you feel largely ambivalent. If there's someone who's a big fan of the United States and its history in your life, be sure to send them this episode so they can get across it and pick apart all the stuff that I got wrong. And I'm looking forward to your company next week as we continue our exploration of American history. In the meantime, a question as ever posed on Reddit to close out the show. This one comes to us from Redditor hit_the_road. Oh, social media. Sorry, I almost forgot. Go and follow the show. Instagram, TikTok. This is only very new that we've got into social media, so I'm forgetting to plug it. Thank you to all the people who are liking, commenting, and subscribing, begging the internet to give me that sweet book deal. But get across. It's just Half Ass History, except on Twitter or X, where it's Half Ass Histoire. No Y wouldn't fit. Very annoying. So if you're on any or all of those platforms, be sure to go and follow the show there. And once again, thank you to all the people who are supporting my endeavors to get stuck into the world of social media. Not enjoying it very much, but it is fun to read through some of the more creative comments at least. So that's that. Anyway, as I say, Redditor Hit the Road wants to know this week, if the founding fathers wanted a strong central government, why isn't Washington, D.C. in Kansas?
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.